Joshua, Chapter 6 and 7, the fourth talk in a series on the narrative portions of Joshua, were presented by David Crabtree on November 13, 2005, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at the Bible this week, Joshua chapter 6 and 7. My plan is to leave time at the end for questions and comments. I'm not positive. My outline ran a little long this week. I'll try to get through all of it. The topic this week is sin, and unfortunately it's a topic about which I know much. Last week I talked about the archaeological background to the fall of Jericho, and this week now we'll look at the actual biblical account. I've talked about before that there are indications that God is kind of stepping back in history. In the Exodus, God stepped forward. God became a player in history and worked overtly in the events that transpired. But now, as we enter into the conquest, there are indications that God is actually stepping back. But he doesn't do it abruptly. He phases himself out. And so in the fall of Jericho, we have an event in which God is once again visibly active. But nevertheless, I think it's true that God is in the process of stepping back. The narrative in this section is very interesting, and I think it's designed to be dramatic, in that as we go through, it is very difficult to systematically piece together exactly what's happening. You get a few pieces of information, and then the narrative progresses further, and you get more pieces of information. And it's like the author is just leaking stuff out. And as he leaks it out, your mind is searching around, trying to picture this thing, and struggling to do so. But it's only at the end that all of the pieces seem to fit into place such that you can visualize it. And I think you'll see that as we progress through here. First section, Joshua 6, 1 through 5. Now Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went out and no one came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and the valiant warriors. And you shall march around the city, all the men of war circling the city once. You shall do so for 6 days. Also, 7 priests shall carry 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. Then on the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And it shall be that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up, every man straight ahead." Jericho is shut up tight. As I talked about last week, the archaeological evidence indicates that there were two walls, there were two rings, and then there was the center city inside the second ring. And it had a very sophisticated gateway entry that made it very difficult for anyone to come in easily. That is to say, they had to walk through this corridor that had walls on both sides before they could get into the city. So the gate was very formidable. Now, there are a couple of things that are interesting about this, and I think the author wants us to recall. The first is the people of Jericho must be scared to death. We know that they knew about the Exodus. They knew about the miracles that took place when the Israelites left Egypt. They knew about the defeats that the kings on the other side of the Jordan suffered at the hands of the Israelites. We can only presume that they also knew about the Jordan River being stopped and the Israelites coming across. They must have known that the Israelites were camped on the west side of the Jordan for several days, very ominously. They knew that some spies had come and had gone. So they must be scared to death. And they've closed up the city as tight as they can. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, this city looks formidable. These are significant fortifications, probably more fortifications than these Israelites have ever seen. Canaan was an area in which there was a lot of warfare between the various cities. And so they developed well-fortified cities in order to protect themselves. And Jericho was among these. It was very highly fortified. The Israelites are coming against Jericho. This has to be the first major fortified city that they've encountered. And the question is, how are they going to do it? How is this going to happen? God gives his instructions to Joshua as to how this is going to happen. And he tells them that the army is supposed to move out, and it will march around the city, and they'll do that for 6 days, once each day. And they will be accompanied by the seven priests, who will each have horns, and they will go before the Ark of the Covenant. So the Ark of the Covenant will accompany them on this parade. Then on the seventh day, they will march around it seven times, and then the priests are going to give one long blow on the trumpets. Everyone will shout, and the walls will come down. And the people will be able to go straight into the city. So that's what God tells Joshua. That's what's going to happen. I'm not sure exactly what the significance of the sevens are. Clearly, I think it encourages to remember the creation account in which God created the world, and then on the seventh day he rested. And I suspect that here it's indicative of the seventh day being the day in which there is culmination to this activity. But in any case, the seven is clearly significant, is clearly symbolic of something. Next section. So Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let seven priests carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord." Then he said to the people, "Go forward and march around the city, and let the armed men go on before the Ark of the Lord." And it was so that when Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward and blew the trumpets, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. And the armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the Ark, while they continued to blow the trumpets. But Joshua commanded the people, saying, "You shall not shout, nor let your voice be heard, nor let a word proceed out of your mouth, until the day I let you shout. Then you shall shout." So he had the Ark of the Lord taken around the city, circling it once. Then they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. It is not clear to me whether all of the Israelites are in this parade or not. It says that he speaks to the people, but it's not clear to me whether that is separate from all of the participants, the army and the priests, or whether that's just the army and the priests. But in any case, we have the army leads the procession. Then that's followed by the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant. And then there's this rear guard that also of armed men that follows behind it. They walk around the city in silence. At least they aren't speaking. No one's speaking. And they're walking around the city. They just do it one time, and then they go back to camp. It must have been a strange sight for the people in Jericho to see. Very, very mysterious. Next section. Now Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the Ark of the Lord, and the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord went on continually and blew the trumpets. And the armed men went before them, and the rear guard came after the ark of the Lord, while they continued to blow the trumpets. Thus the second day they marched around the city once and returned to camp. They did so for 6 days. A number of times in the Old Testament, you have a section start out with someone rose up early, and that seems to be always indicative of someone eager to take action. We have Joshua rising up early in the morning, and they move out, and now we get a clearer picture of what's going on. The trumpets are blowing all the time. So they're walking around the walls of Jericho with the trumpets blowing continually. And that's what happened for 6 days. Then it came about on the seventh day that they rose early at the dawning of the day and marched around the city in the same manner 7 times. Only on that day they marched around the city 7 times. And it came about at the seventh time, when the priests blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city, and the city shall be under the ban. It and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, lest you covet them and take some of the things under the ban. So you would make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So the people shouted, and the priests blew the trumpets, and it came about, when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, that the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. And they utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. So the seventh day comes. This time they march around the city 7 times. And after they have marched around the city 7 times, Joshua says, "Shout." So this is the first time they've heard the people making a sound other than the horns. They're all shouting at once. And when they do so, the walls come down. And the priests are blowing their trumpet at the same time that the shouting's happening. So it must have been very intimidating. And Joshua said that the city is under a ban. What that means is that the people, the men who go into Jerusalem, into Jericho, are not to take anything. Everything is supposed to remain where it is. Things will be burned. Every man, woman, child, every animal is to be put to death. All of their belongings are to be left there. The only thing that they are to collect are the things that are made of metal, whether it's gold, silver, bronze, or iron. Those things are to be collected, and those will go into the treasury of the house of the Lord. So those will be used, presumably, to make utensils for the for service of the Lord. But everything else is to be left in place and to be destroyed. No one is supposed to take any of it. He says, "But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, lest you covet them and take some of the things under the ban. So you would make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it." So that's the ban that's placed on Jericho, the instructions that they were giving as they go into it. So the walls do fall flat, and as the archaeological evidence shows, something happened, and the archaeologists speculate that it was an earthquake. But as those diagrams that I showed you last week indicate, the walls were built on an earthen parapet. So it's a slope that goes up that is packed earth. Then on top of that, there were brick walls. And when the city was shaken, or if it was an earthquake, whatever happened, those bricks that composed the wall, they tumbled down the slope and essentially made a ramp up which the people of Israel were able to walk right into the city. So they go into the city and they put to death everyone who is there except for Rahab and her household. They had remembered the promise that the spies had made to Rahab. She will not be touched. And that's part of the instructions that were given. She and her household will be spared. Verse 22, and Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all she has out of there, as you have sworn to her. So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. They also brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. And they burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. However, Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. So Joshua specifically instructs the spies to go in and locate Rahab and to make sure that she is identified so that she and her household can be spared. He brings out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, all of her close relatives, and all of their possessions. So the possessions of her family are saved. They are not under the ban. Then they take out all the metal items that are made of metal, and then they torch the city, which is what the archaeological record shows. There is a thick burn layer in the upper city of Jericho. And it points out that Rahab has lived in the midst of Israel to this day. So she is taken in as one of the Israelites. Because of what she did. Verse 26, then Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds this city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son he shall set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. So Joshua places a curse on Jericho, and apparently the curse is on anyone who would rebuild it, refortify it, rebuild the walls, because it says, the man who rises up and builds this city Jericho, his firstborn he shall, at the loss of his firstborn he shall lay its foundation. With the loss of the youngest son he shall set up its gates. So what seems to be indicated is when the fortifications are, if it's built into a fortified city again. And we have record of what happened there in 1 Kings 16:34. It was during the reign of Ahab, who was a particularly wicked king. A man rebuilt the walls of Jericho, and he did so at the expense of his firstborn and of his youngest. And that was about 400 years after the events that we're talking about here. And then the last verse, the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. So it is clear, not just to the Israelites, but it's clear to the people who live in Canaan, that God is doing something unique and something special through the Israelites. And in fact, the success of the Israelites is dependent upon this fear that God has spread throughout Canaan. They are not a mighty force, and we'll see later that Joshua doesn't see them as a mighty force. That rather, the key to their success is God working on their behalf. And when it says Joshua's fame was spread throughout the land, that fame is critical for their success. That's all part of what God's doing. It's not their warcraft that is the key to their success. It's what God is doing. And the Israelites know that. That's why the next verse is particularly ominous. Chapter 7, verse 1. But the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. Therefore the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. So we get this ominous note that there was a member of the Israelite army who violated the ban that God had placed on Jericho. And they will pay for this. 2-5. Now Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth-Aven, east of Bethel, and said to them, "Go out and spy out the land." So the men went up and spied out Ai. And they returned to Joshua and said to him, "Do not let all the people go up. Only about 2,000 or 3,000 men need to go up to Ai. Do not make all the people toil up there, for they are few." So about 3,000 men from the people went up there, but they fled from the men of Ai. And the men of Ai struck down about 36 of their men and pursued them from the gate as far as Shebarim and struck them down on the descent. So the hearts of the people melted and became as water. The next city, and if you have a map and you look at it, is just east of Jericho. The next city is Ai. And once again, as the Israelites have done repeatedly, they send out scouts, they send out spies to figure out how they should assemble their attack. I'll just make a little note here. It is interesting that God is with the Israelites. They know that God is with him. But as they proceed, they take the prudent measures that seem prudent, those measures which seem prudent, they take those. And their assumption seems to be that God will work through those prudent measures that they take. So they send spies out to reconnoiter. And the spies come back and say, "Oh, this is a piece of cake. This is going to be easy. There aren't many people there at Ai. Apparently it's not highly fortified. This will be an easy city to take. You're only going to need 2,000 to 3,000 men." It's interesting. Joshua went with the higher number. He goes with the 3,000. It's 3,000 men that he sends to Ai. But what happens is when they challenge the men of Ai in combat, they are routed. The Israelite army flees, and the men of Ai chase them and are able to kill 36 of the Israelites. And it says, "So the hearts of the people melted and became as water." That's exactly what had happened to the Canaanites when they realized that the Israelites were coming through the help of God, that their hearts melted. Well, now it's the reverse. Now it's the Israelites whose hearts have melted, because the Israelites understand how dependent they are on God's activity for them to be successful. And they are also aware of the morale factor and this sense that if God is with them, then they are invincible. But now that they have been defeated, that sense of invincibility starts to melt away. And now they're afraid that their weakness as an army will be shown. And the Canaanites will begin to take advantage of it. And we'll see that in what Joshua says. Verse 6. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until the evening, both he and the elders of Israel. And they put dust on their heads. And Joshua said, "Alas, O Lord God, why didst thou ever bring this people over the Jordan? only to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. If only we had been willing to dwell beyond the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say since Israel has turned their back before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it, and they will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what wilt thou do for thy great name? Joshua is clearly perplexed. He doesn't know what to make of what has just happened. His understanding was that God was leading them in to conquer the Palestine, and he would lead them to complete victory in Palestine, and they would truly possess the land. And here, the second battle, they're routed. What's going on? And he says, why did you bring this people over the Jordan? Why couldn't we have just stayed on the other side of the Jordan? Why couldn't we have been happy to remain there? That would have been better than to come here and be destroyed, be surrounded and destroyed by the Canaanites. This all sounds familiar. It's much like what was said in the wilderness by the people and on one occasion by Moses. Verse 10. So the Lord said to Joshua, rise up. Why is it that you have fallen on your face? Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant which I commanded them. And they have even taken some of the things under the ban, and have both stolen and deceived. Moreover, they have also put them among their own things. Therefore, the sons of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. They turn their backs before their enemies, for they have become accursed. I will not be with you anymore unless you destroy the things under the ban from your midst. Rise up, consecrate the people, and say, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow. For thus the Lord, the God of Israel, has said, there are things under the ban in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you have removed the things under the ban from your midst. In the morning, then, you shall come near by your tribes, and it shall be that the tribe which the Lord takes by lot shall come near by families, and the family which the Lord takes shall come near by households, and the household which the Lord takes shall come near man by man. And it shall be that the one who is taken with the things under the ban shall be burned with fire, he and all that belongs to him, because he has transgressed the covenant of the Lord, and because he has committed a disgraceful thing in Israel. So God explains that what has happened is that someone violated the ban. And because someone had violated the ban, Israel is being punished. And that things will not be rectified until the things that were taken under the ban are taken back and that those are burned. And God makes explicit what Joshua and the people have assumed all along. He says, because they have taken things under the ban in 12, therefore the sons of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. God is indeed the one who has made them successful. It says they turn their backs before their enemies, for they have become accursed. So the people are supposed to rise up, they're supposed to consecrate themselves, and God is going to indicate who it was that violated the ban. And that happens in the next section. Verse 16. So Joshua arose early in the morning and brought Israel nearby tribes. And the tribe of Judah was taken. And he brought the family of Judah near. And he took the family of the Zerahites. And he brought the family of the Zerahites near man by man. And Zabdi was taken. And he brought his household near man by man. And Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, was taken. Then Joshua said to Achan, my son, I implore you, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give praise to him, and tell me now what you have done. Do not hide it from me. So Achan answered Joshua and said, truly I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel, and this is what I did. when I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar, and 200 shekels of silver, and a bar of gold 50 shekels in weight, then I coveted them and took them, and behold, they are concealed in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath it. This process of identifying the guilty person must have been truly agonizing for Achan. Can you imagine your tribe being designated, then your, what's the next smaller group, your family, your household, and then you? I mean, it keeps coming closer and closer to putting the finger right on you. He knows he's guilty, and it just keeps getting closer and closer to him. That must have been an agonizing process. But he is indicated as the one who had taken the things that were placed under a ban. And Joshua asks him to confess, and he does so. He did indeed take the things under the ban. And he explains that he saw a mantle from Shinar. Shinar is Mesopotamia. Shinar is back where Babylon is located. So something from Shinar would have been an import. This would have been probably the classiest kind of product that one could find in the ancient Near East. And he sees this mantle, this import, this luxury good of luxury goods. He sees it, and he cannot resist. As one who had grown up in the wilderness, one who probably doesn't remember Egypt, this has to be something that's beyond his imaginings. This is really something special. And there's silver, and there's gold, and he can't help himself. He takes those things that were placed under the ban. He takes those home, and he buries them in the sand underneath his tent. Verse 22. So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran to the tent, and behold, it was concealed in his tent with the silver underneath it. And they took them from inside the tent and brought them to Joshua and to all the sons of Israel, and they poured them out before the Lord. Then Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, the silver, the mantle, the bar of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all that belonged to him. And they brought them up to the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." And all Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. And they raised over them a great heap of stones that stands to this day. And the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor to this day. So they take him out, and they take everything that he owns. They take his whole household, all of his animals. All of that is put to death. Achan and presumably all of his family are stoned to death, and then everything is burned altogether. And once again, they heap up a bunch of stones as a marker. I'm getting the picture that as someone were to walk around Palestine, the landscape would be dotted with these heaps of stones, and those become a kind of visual history for the Israelites, to remember both the good and the bad. It's a way for them to remember where they've been and how they got where they are. Having done that, then, the Lord turned his anger from the people of Israel. And the valley was named Achor, which means trouble. There are two things that I would like to talk about with respect to these two chapters. The first is this issue of collective responsibility. Why is it that God chooses to treat the collective rather than single out individuals. And we see there are two examples in this passage of God choosing to deal with the collective. One is Rahab. Rahab, who had trusted in the God of the Israelites, feared the God of the Israelites, and therefore helped the spies, she was spared from the fate of Jericho. But not just Rahab. It was Rahab and the entire household were spared, and all of their belongings. So God chose to deal with Rahab as the collective group, as a household, rather than individually. The same thing is true of Achan. Achan is the one who took the items under the ban. Nevertheless, God has chosen to punish the entire household. They're treated as a group. Why would God do this? I don't know, but here are my thoughts. I think as Americans, we tend to minimize the extent to which we are a part of the larger group, whether we like it or not. As Americans, we emphasize individualism and think in terms of each person being an island in and of himself. But most of the cultures of the world don't see it that way. And I think there are good reasons not to see it that way. We are part of a collective. Like it or not, we are all part of a collective. We are part of our family. We are part of our subculture. We are part of the larger culture. And we are significantly shaped by that culture that surrounds us. It has a huge impact on the way that we act and things that we think, what we do. We are most influenced by our microculture, the culture that's closest to us, and in particular our families. But we are also shaped by, to one degree or another, by that larger culture. We are all shaped by American culture. It is also true that we all contribute to that culture. We all help make that culture what it is. Once again, our biggest impact is on the smaller culture that's around us, our family, and then on our microculture, and then to a much lesser extent to the larger culture. But it's a two-way street. We are both influenced by our culture, and we help shape that culture. So we are integrally tied into the culture that surrounds us. The same is true of this church. This church is a microculture. We are all influenced by it, and we all have an impact on this culture. We help shape this culture. It shapes us, and we make it. As a result, we as a church have a corporate character, like it or not, and we are all complicit in that corporate character. And our culture either encourages us to do good or it discourages us. And there are two levels on which that happens. One is just social pressure. Social pressure is a reality. We all want to fit in. And because we all want to fit in, we all want to abide by the norms of that culture. And that exerts pressure on us. We don't want to be seen as one who flagrantly violates the norms of our culture. I thank God for social pressure. To the extent that it influences me to do good and it keeps me within certain boundaries of proper behavior, that's a good thing. It's not righteousness, but it's a good thing. There's a sense in which it keeps me from committing acts that would have significant ramifications and keeps me within certain boundaries. But culture can have a further influence that I think is much more significant. And that is, the culture around us can serve to edify us. the culture around us can actually be used to encourage us to do that which is good and right, to hunger and thirst after righteousness. I assume that that's true. I assume that people can play a role in my life to encourage me to do that which is truly good, not just social pressure, but to do what is truly good. I assume that because God encourages us to play a role in one another's lives and to do that very thing, to encourage one another to seek after righteousness. So a culture can do that. And that's a great thing. And generally speaking, if I have a heart for God, I will be attracted to others who have a heart for God. And we can become a culture, a mini culture, a micro culture that encourages one another to seek after that which is truly good, to hunger and thirst after righteousness. It is interesting to think, what about the family of Rahab? Were they like-minded? We have no indication in the text that I can find. But it's possible that they were like-minded. That family certainly produced a woman who feared God. And it's possible that that family was of such a nature that it encouraged that, that it allowed that. Likewise, with Achan, it could be that the whole household contributed to his lawlessness, that it was a family of lawlessness. We aren't told, we don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me, because we do all have a huge impact on one another. In any case, what we see in the Old Testament record is that God frequently deals with the collective in history. Notice that there were 36 men, soldiers, who died because of what Achan had done. They didn't do anything. They aren't singled out for wrongdoing. There's no indication that they did anything wrong. But they died because of what Achan did. And part of the question that we have to deal with as we make our way through life is, will we allow God to tell the story that he wants to tell the way he wants to tell it? That is to say, are we even willing to allow God to treat people unfairly? At least from our perspective, it appears to be unfair. Are we willing to allow God to treat people unfairly in order to tell the story that he wants to tell? Are we willing to allow God to have 36 men cut down because of what Achan did? And that's part of what we have to work through. Are we willing to allow God to be the God that he is? And are we willing to allow those who are not worthy to benefit? But even if God deals with people at the collective level in history, we have to remember that he's also dealing with individuals throughout. He's always dealing with individuals. God is doing a very complex thing in history. He's able to work with the collective and tell the story that he wants to tell, but at the same time, he is able to work individually in the lives of every one of us to bring about our purposes there. And we know that the final judgment is individual. We are ultimately responsible for the choices that we as an individual make. And we will stand before God on the basis of that. The other thing I want to talk about is Achan's sin. It is very easy for me to identify with what Achan did. Just imagine Achan. He's one of the soldiers that marched around Jericho the 7 days. And he's one of the soldiers that when the walls come down, he rushes in. I suspect that Achan had every intention of following the restrictions that Joshua had laid out. He had every intention of following the ban. But what happens? He goes into Jericho, he looks down, and he notices a mantle that is nicer than anyone that he's ever seen before. And he is just awestruck. He's just awestruck by what he sees. He looks around, and no one is nearby. He's in some kind of corner of Jericho or something. So no one sees him, and he starts thinking. He starts rationalizing. I know this process. He looks at it and he says, "That is a really nice mantle. It is virtually irreplaceable. You couldn't find one as fine as that elsewhere. It's a shame that this should be burned. It's a waste of a very good thing." And he starts thinking, if I were to take it, no one would be hurt. This is a victimless crime. How could anyone be hurt? I'm just taking a mantle. And then he sees the silver and the gold underneath it, by it, someplace around. And he thinks to himself, all of this has to be turned over to God for the temple, but there's a lot of that that's going to be turned over to God for the temple. This doesn't really make much difference. This is just a few coins. I could benefit greatly from it. I'll take those two. And he starts thinking, let's see, now the ban. The ban was nothing could be taken in the city. Well, if this stuff was 100 yards over there, I could take it. What's the difference? What difference does 100 yards make? And Joshua's ban is stupid anyway. And I'm sure that's why he's thinking about it. It's Joshua's ban. It's not God's. It's Joshua's ban. That's the same move that the Israelites had made with respect to Moses in the wilderness. Joshua's ban is stupid anyway. Etc., etc. You guys probably all know the process. And he's looking at these things and he's saying, these things are a good. They are not inherently wicked. It's only this stupid ban that keeps me from taking them. And to take in them is not a big deal anyway. It's just a few things out of lots. So he wants to take these things. He hides them under his cloak or whatever, and he takes those back and he buries them under his tent, thinking that what he does in the privacy of his own tent is his own business. What's interesting here is this dilemma that we all face many times a day. The question that we're faced with constantly is, what do we value? I wish that God had so made human existence that we could make that decision once and be done with it. God has not so constructed reality. We have to make that decision hundreds of times a day. We have to keep revisiting that decision and ratifying our greater decision with respect to who will be our Lord. And the question is constantly, what do we value more, doing what God wants or doing what my sinful self wants? In other words, do I want righteousness or bling bling? I mean, that's what it comes down to. And there is a lot of bling bling in life. And we all can list them. I mean, it's like wealth, power, sexual pleasure, entertainment, fame, and we could list more. But if you think about it, that's all it is. It's just bling bling. I mean, it's all passing stuff. It's all trinkets. But in the moment, it's really hard to see it that way. In the moment, it looks like a good. And those things are in their rightful place. They are goods. If God chooses to give them to us, when He gives them to us, given to us in the right way, they are goods. But they are never to be elevated over the pursuit of righteousness. And that's what we're constantly tempted to do, is to make that inversion where we take bling bling and make it valuable. We take bling bling and make it more important than righteousness. It is unfortunate, on the one hand, that we have to revisit that decision many times a day, on the one hand. But on the other hand, it's probably good. We have lots of chances, lots of redos. And God seems to have constructed the human existence in such a way that we keep coming back to that struggle where we have to ask ourselves, is it righteousness or is it bling bling? What is it that I value? And I used to think that a half victory with respect to that was a failure. I no longer see it that way. Our goal is, it is unrealistic to go for a perfect record. A half victory is better than not wrestling at all. That it is that wrestling as much as we can to the best of our ability to pursue righteousness. That's what we're called to. And we pray that God will give us the strength and the wisdom to know how to do that and to keep up the fight. And to keep wrestling, despite those times when we fail. There are no victimless crimes. Anytime we sin, our soul is negatively affected. There is damage done. And we take our souls wherever we go. And that damaged soul has an impact on others. There are no victimless sins. The struggle to keep fighting to do that which is right is something that we have to just keep working on, just keep doing, and pray that God will help us in that fight, knowing that ultimately we will be victorious, that that is what God has called us to, and that's what God will do. There's a little time left. Questions and comments. There's probably more hands than time, but we'll see what we can do.
David, I don't think it's quite that introverted a matter. When I look at this particular section, the point that comes to me is that taking the spoils of combat is indirectly the same as taking credit for the win. As Achan, I'm calling attention to myself because I've rationalized that I deserve it. This is sinning because it's not giving God the total glory to me. Instead, it's giving the glory to me, and the spiritual significance, therefore, of this account of the ban is to remind me that in my walk of faith, that the victory over the enemy was totally the Lord Jesus Christ and not from my efforts or the efforts of the community of believers.
That's true.
David, I appreciate what you've done today. Thank you.
Thanks.
I thought I'd bring a little fun into this. I'm kind of a numbers person.
Okay.
The Jewish people believed in sacred numbers, which were 3, 7, and 12.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you mentioned the number 7 as completeness or culmination. The pyramids are built on those numbers and their root, square roots, and relationships between them. So here you had 36 people killed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's 3 times 12.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose 3,000, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
If you divide 3,000 into 36, what do you get? 0.012. Okay, who says God isn't orderly? I think there is a study on Jericho on engineering that proved why the wall would come down based on the vibration. And I don't remember. I remember reading it one time, but somebody had proven. So God's an engineer, you know. He's the ultimate engineer. We'll talk about the collectivist thing afterwards. I won't get into that. But I thought that was interesting, the numbers, because I've always watched the numbers in the Bible.
I think the numbers are worthy of attention. I do not yet know exactly what to make of the numbers. I think it is the case that some numbers are used, and it has to be the case, that in some cases the numbers in the Old Testament are used symbolically.
Yeah.
It is difficult to figure out exactly, it's difficult for me to figure out exactly what significance to attach to the various numbers, when to see them as symbolically and when not to see them as symbolically. But that is a topic that I think is worth consideration.
Yeah, well, I just thought I'd point that out so you could think about it. Okay.
Thanks.
David, I was thinking, I can think of another way that I often rationalize my sin is by, even if there's a ban on spoils of war or whatever, I think to myself, there are no coincidences with God, and God knows that I need this.
Mm-hmm.
Is God actually trying to make a special dispensation for me because he's put this in front of me?
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty easy for me to do.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. I'll remember that. If I run out of others.
Let's see. Since the Israelites were walking around Jericho for 7 days, one of those days had to be the Sabbath.
Right.
So do we have any idea which one?
No, there's no indication. But
did they get a note from God that said they could go around?
A path, yeah. I think that is very interesting. That did occur to me. And I think it would be an interesting study to go through the Old Testament and find the various situations in which laws of the Old Testament laws were countermanded for some other purpose, like David taking the showbread. And I think that would be an interesting study.
I actually had two questions. I'll make them quick.
Okay.
Jericho was razed and burned. And I was flipping through, trying to madly remember because it never stuck out to me before. They didn't do that with every city they came across, though, I'm pretty sure. Certainly not every city was cursed.
Right.
I didn't see any indication previously that Jericho had some special measure of sin in it that would give it that. I was curious why they did that with that city. You know, they acted defensively, but they didn't try and seduce the Israelites to their ways like some previous groups had. Why did he point them out for that?
Well, we have the blanket statement that was made. I can't remember who ends up making the statement, but the iniquity of the Canaanites was not yet full. That's why the Israelites were not yet to go into to take Canaan. So presumably, when they are coming into Canaan, the iniquities of the Canaanites are full. So there is a judgment is due them from God's perspective. My recollection, we'll have to see as we proceed through, but my recollection is that they do kill everyone in the cities that they take. I don't know that they burn them all. And I don't know that they have the same rules as far as taking the metal and giving that to God. My recollection is that ban holds for the other cities that they go to. But you're right, no curse is placed on other cities. Why Jericho?
I know that some of the cities they are allowed to take spoil. I know the next city they are. But the curse did seem kind of odd for that one. The other question I had was as it relates to the death of Achan and his family. I'm not sure if this was my own idea or if I read it somewhere, probably read it, but stoning was a singularly unusual type of punishment because it both made the death a collective one and a non-personal one because no individual person, Every person killed them, and no one did.
Right.
No person had to bear the weight of having murdered someone else or thinking they had.
Right.
But God didn't tell them to stone them. He said to put them he said to burn them.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically, he didn't have a problem with it because it doesn't mention that he then corrected Joshua for not having burned them only, but having stoned them also. Did you come across anything odd with that as far as seemingly they didn't exactly follow his direction in how he said to put them to death?
I don't think we're intended to see it as a situation where they didn't follow his instructions. What God is saying is that they need to be burned.
Mm-hmm.
Joshua is just filling in the procedures by which that will be accomplished. And the procedure includes execution by stoning. So I don't think we're intended to see that as Joshua doing something that's inconsistent with what God had commanded. We need to stop there. Thanks.